The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's all about the rock and roll today. We've got the 30th anniversary of Skid Row's classic self-titled debut album with founding members Dave Snake Sabo and Rachel Bolan, my bros. But before we get to that, we got to get to my other bro, the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, did you hear about the new movie? It's Duff McKagan, by the way. Hear about the new movie Stallone, Bruce Willis, and Schwarzenegger going to make about classical composers? Yeah. Stallone said, I'll be Mozart. And Bruce Willis said, I'll be Beethoven. And Schwarzenegger said, well, in that case, I'll be Bach. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That is a good one. That is a Duff classic. I wonder how long it took for him to come up with that one. Actually, he told me on the sly that he actually... If you ever heard him on Talk is Jericho a couple of years ago, that him and Axl Rose exchanged these jokes on stage and personally. So some of these might even be Axl Rose jokes. So, and no coincidence that we talked about Bach, considering we're talking about Sebastian Bach with Skid Row on the 30th anniversary of their classic debut record. And speaking of classics, it was a classic Duff joke. Gotta love Duff for sending them out to us every week without fail. I want you to go see the Tenderness Tour when it returns to the States September 25th. DuffOnline.com is all the ticket info. My good friend Dan Shinsky went and saw him at the Islington Academy in London last week and said that Duff was amazing. Shooter Jennings was amazing. A little bit of a different pace for Duff. It's not kick-ass rock and roll. It's very kick-ass inspirational music, internal music, singer-songwriter type music. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. DuffOnline.com for all ticket info. And you're going to enjoy Skid Row live as well, starting some dates on September 25th. Dave Snake Sabo and Rachel Bolan and the guys will be in Lubbock, Texas. They're doing the Rock Out Cancer in Louisville, Kentucky on October 4th. Rock in Q on the Plains on October 18th. And then they're heading to Europe in November. Get your tickets at skidrow.com. Skid Row's also working on a new album with longtime producer Michael Wagner. He also did the original debut record back in 1989. We'll hear all about that and the relationship that they've had for years. Coming up from Snake and Rach as we talk about the 30th anniversary of the band's self-titled classic debut record, Youth Gone Wild, I Remember You, Piece of Me, 18 in Life, so many great tunes. We leave nothing uncovered from the songwriting, the recording, the artwork on the cover, the role that Jon Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora played in Skid Row's career, which is very monumental. I did not know that. So we'll get to Snake and Rachel on the Skype line right now. Here we go. Skid Row 30th anniversary begins now.
Hello.
Hello.
What's happening?
How you doing, man?
You hear me all right?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear
cool,
you great.
Cool. I'm just going to add Mr. B here, and we should be all set.
All right.
What?
What? Where?
What? Hey, Rach.
What up, man?
What's up, dude? All right. This is great, man. It's nice to have you guys on, and we actually figured out the Skype, so we're actually high-tech rock and rollers today.
Look at us go.
I know. Look at us go. Listen, we could have a stupid small talk bullshit, but let's just talk about what we want to talk about today, which is every once in a while you get a record that comes out that's very influential. It's monumental. This record is not one of them, but it.
I couldn't agree more.
No, seriously, it's the 30th year anniversary of the very first Skid Row record. And I'm sure you guys feel it too. It's one of those things where you're like, holy shit, like I remember when this record came out. I can't believe it's been 30 years already since the release. Does it feel strange for you guys?
Man, yes, it does. It feels really strange. It's when you're putting a band together, you're just hope to make it to the next gig. And hopefully, you know, you get an opportunity to release the music that you helped create. And while we all have lofty ambitions, the reality is that a lot of bands fall by the wayside and you know, last for a little while, then fizzle out. And for us, we just wanted the opportunity to make a record and then sell enough records to have the opportunity to make another one. I mean, we all, like I said, had these desires to be successful, but we really just wanted the opportunity to make music for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to exist 30 years later, still in the consciousness of the public is very, very humbling.
Yeah, it was one of those things, you know, you dream of this happening your whole life, because I mean, Snake and I were of the same mindset even before we knew each other. We knew we were on a collision course with playing music for the rest of our lives. Now, you know, you're cocky and then, yep, I'm going to do this. And then you come out with an album or your first record that stands the test of time. You know what I mean? And for just to look back, I mean, whenever anyone over the past year or so, anyone's saying, wow, man, your first album came out 30 years ago. Honestly, dude, I didn't even know I was going to make it to 30.
Exactly.
Because we were in our early 20s when we wrote it. And, you know, we knew we liked it. And then we started playing clubs and other people started liking it. And then everything just happened so fast. And all of a sudden, boom, 30 years later, here we are. And people are actually celebrating the record. It's an amazing feeling to be able to do that. And the more I see it, it's a rare occurrence. You know what I mean? Where people actually still like you after 30 years.
Yeah, I know.
And not to mention where you guys have, like, you know, we'll talk about the whole record because it is, I've done a show before with the guys from Avenged Sevenfold, it was called The Perfect Album. And what constitutes a perfect album? Every song has to be an A- or better, according to whoever's listening to it. And this is one of those perfect records where every song on here, to me, is A- or better pretty much across the board. And it's funny that the fact you guys wrote this in your early 20s, it always amazed me when you talk about the Beatles and the Stones or Metallica doing, you know, Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets. And here you guys are, I don't know how old you were, 23, 24, writing these tunes that still, like you said, anybody that grew up in that era knows Youth Gone Wild and knows I Remember You and knows 18 in Life and still plays them to this day. And you were just kids when you wrote them.
Well, no one could predict what's going to connect with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, like with us, with Rachel and I, we just were connecting with each other. And so when we started first writing together, we didn't know each other all that well. So we were still finding our way. We were sort of navigating this friendship that's grown to be like best friends over the course of time. And we met in like late 85 at the music store in Tom's River, where Rachel's hometown. We just saw, I think we saw a kindred spirit in each other. But you don't know until you get in that room and you shut the door and you got two guitars and you go, okay, here's an idea. Or what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And then all of a sudden you start creating something. And you've never had that feeling before of what's starting to happen. And you don't even know what it is. You just know that it's something really good. And then, not that the first songs we ever wrote were really good, but it was the experience of being able to connect with another person who was of the same mindset and had the same aspirations and the same ambition and the same work ethic. And so you're going, holy crap, man, like there's something here. And let's keep pursuing this. And it was really rewarding. And we were still working, you know, two jobs, and we were struggling financially as individuals, as young adults. But there was this exuberance that was going on whenever we got together. And then we started just putting the pieces of the band together to surround us with people who had the same sort of ambition and work ethic, and but we had a goals set in mind. And but the biggest thing is you want to connect with people. You want people to hopefully get what it is that you're emoting. So it was always a very honest and pure pathway for us. We weren't trying to be anybody else. We just wanted to express ourselves because it was the only way that we knew how.
Yeah, Snake was the first guy I ever wrote with. I mean, I always wrote songs by myself. And we got into a room and I wasn't sure how it was going to go. And all of a sudden I remember there was this one song called Telephone. I could sing it a chorus right now. And it just came out and I was like, wow, this is a really cool song. It didn't make the record, but it was such a strong start for us as songwriting partners that to this day, I remember the song. I could write the lyrics down right now. And it was just one of those things. And I knew that I was like, wow, if this is our first shot, what is going to come out next? You know,
that's true. I felt the same way.
I love the fact you guys said you met at the record store. What a lost era of
music store.
You could go.
No, it was a music store. We sold music instruments and
gotcha.
Rachel would come in. I started working down there because no one would hire me up in my town of Sayreville or the area around there unless it was a warehouse gig. But anything else, I had to cut my hair. I was like, there's no way. And so through various channels, I got a job at Garden State Music in Toms River, which was about an hour and 20 minutes from where I lived. And I had to take a couple buses to get down there because I didn't have a license. It was suspended and whatever. So I started working there, and I started working in like the back room, the storage room, and I started doing inventories and mail order stuff. And I graduated up front. And I used to see Rachel walk in, and you could just sense that this guy was a rock star. Like, he just had an aura about him. The way he held himself, the way he looked, the clothes that he wore, he's very, you know, he was just stood out in a room full of people. You would focus on him. And I was like, I was never really shy about going up and introducing myself to people and throwing a load of garbage at them just to prop my own self up. But it's true. And
my back hurt from picking up all the names he dropped.
Yeah, my back still hurts. But he was a star. And so I was like, man, I need, you know, one of the things that I was taught was that you always align yourself with people who are better at what you do than you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what he did. I think one of my friends, Ed, who was a mutual friend, said, oh, yeah, he's a bass player with this band, Godsend. And I was like, oh, man, I got to get to know this guy. And so struck up a conversation. It was funny and friendly. And it just went from there. And just the fact that, you know, I lived so far away and came to work at this music store in his hometown and the music store that he would go to, like it was his music store. It's so bizarre and just, it's serendipitous, you know, it was meant to happen.
And what's crazy is just because of that he came down, I go, oh, this guy's going to work as hard as I like to work for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're going to get along really good because I saw that. I was like, man, if he gets on two buses and comes 2 hours down to work just so he could be in a band, I want to be in a band with this guy. Guitar player was in my band at the time.
But that's the thing too. Like you always get those kindred spirits, and it's the eternal story of rock and roll, of the fateful meetings between, you know, Mick and Keith at the bus station, or you know, Paul and John, or Gene and Paul, and you know, Steven and Joe. And so it's like you said, it was meant to be. Now usually it's the singer and the guitar player. This time it's the guitar player and the bass player, who of course you guys wrote all the tunes anyway. So that's the crux of Skid Row then, and it always is up until this day.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing because to maintain a band for 30 years is just, it was beyond our scope of belief. But what's even more amazing is that when you not only do you remain friends with the guy that you started the band with, but your relationship has gotten stronger through the years. And it's really funny because no matter what, no matter where we've gone with this band and what we've done outside of it, the one thing that you could always count on with the two of us is that we always have each other's back.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, man, as you grow older, you understand the value of that, and you can't put a price on it, because it really is like, man, you know, there's been a lot of tough times for everybody, but it makes it easier when you know you got the other guy that you're always going to be able to lean on no matter what. I mean, no matter what. Hmm. And there's been a lot of whats.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Speaking of leaning on, I know in the early days, there was a real close connection with you and Jon Bon Jovi. Did you guys grow up together?
Yeah, we grew up like three streets away from each other in a little town called Sayreville, New Jersey.
That's amazing.
I was going to visit a friend of mine that lived across the street from him. I was about 10 years old, 11 years old, and he was playing basketball in his front yard with this gross blue basketball. It was ridiculous. And it sort of exemplifies what his current fashion choices are. So I basically was this little cocky kid who was really good at basketball. I'm like, hey, you want to play one-on-one? He's like, yeah. He's a couple years older than me, and we played one-on-one, and we became friends from that point forward and have remained friends to this day. I mean, we just got done doing two shows with those guys in Austria and these incredible stadiums. And, you know, 44 years later, we're still buds, and that just says a lot for who, you know, the manner in which we grew up and how we were all raised, and just the value of what a friendship is.
And it tells you how much pain we can endure. No, sorry.
Yeah, true.
Well, it must have been hard for you too, Snake, hanging out with Bon Jovi, because he's so hot and you're like not.
Well, the truth of the matter is that you're absolutely right. But it's my charm that gets me to the ladies.
Because Bon Jovi helped you out quite a bit. Did he help you get a record deal? Because I think their band took off 3 or 4 years before Skid Row did.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rachel. Him and Richie were they were champions for us, man. They helped us out a lot, like a lot. Just kind of like, okay, look at things this way when you're writing a song. Because we knew what we wanted, and we knew that we must have been doing something good for those guys to be that interested in us.
Yeah.
But they introduced us to a lot of people. They got us in front of a lot of people. And they had a big part. And I know we delivered the goods as well, but yeah, they had a big part in helping us out, helping us get to the people that we needed to get our music to, for sure.
They were great coaches. We would throw everything at them that we were writing, and they were great coaches because they pushed us. They were like, this is good, but it ain't great yet. Go make it great.
Yeah.
And it was, I got to admit, and Rachel will attest to this as well, it was frustrating for us at times because they set the bar really, really high. And I look back on that, and I'm sure Rachel does too, and go, thank God for that. And I don't think there's enough of that in today's music, where you're being really, really put to the test, and you have to grow as a writer, and you have to reach loftier heights. And they pushed us like you would not believe. Like, it's almost there, but it's not there. Go back in the room and do it. And we would sit there. Our days consisted of going to work at the music store or whatever other job that we had, going and then going back to Rachel's parents' house and getting in the green room, which is what we called it because it had green paneling in it. And
green paneling, green carpet, yeah. Everything was green.
working until all hours of the night, and then, you know, oftentimes 5-6 in the morning, and then getting up at 8:30 to go into the work again, and then bringing the songs to John and Richie and them going, okay, that's, there you go. Like, and now, and then all of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, okay, there's a little light at the end of the tunnel. Now we're, you know, and Doc McGee as well. And it was Doc who got, you know, who was dealing with the record labels once that we had all the pieces of the puzzle together. But it was John and Richie who were really great, unbelievable coaches, and really. Yeah.
And they were such hard workers themselves that they instilled that in us. I mean, we kind of had that in our wiring anyway, because of how we were taught and raised, that like my old man used to say, never be afraid of hard work. So that was already in me, and it was in Snake from his mom. And so we applied that to songwriting and just, okay, man, if you're in this, you have to be in this 100%, you know? And that's we still, to this day, that's the way we think. It's like, don't go into anything half-assed, or it's just going to come out half-assed, you know? Yeah.
It's very much it's a Jersey attitude, right? Kind of hard work and blue collar state.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people up there are just like the drive and ambition to do whatever it is that you're setting out to do. It's just kind of that way.
Did you guys ever run into Zach Wilde at that point in time? Because I know he was playing in Jersey too.
Oh yeah.
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 Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah. Just there's a lot of
those. He used to come in the music store and he was such a shy 18-year-old kid. And he was playing in a band called Zyrus, which was predominantly like a top 40 band, more in the lines of doing covers by Journey and Styx and bands like that.
Yeah, when the top 40 had cool stuff on it.
Right.
Right. And then he'd break into a guitar solo in the middle of the show. And he's just, again, he is not the person that he is today. I mean, he's like so vibrant and, you know, full of life and just outrageous and stuff today. Back then he wasn't. He was almost the polar opposite. But he would break into the solo and you'd be like, what am I watching? Like, it was so obvious that this guy was going to do great. I remember first time he came into the music store, he's like all like kind of quiet and stuff. He's like, can I grab a guitar off the wall? I was like, yeah, of course, man. Didn't know him. And he grabs like a Les Paul off and just starts playing these riffs. I'm going, whoa, what's going on? Then he puts that away and he goes, can I take that nylon string off? And starts playing classical guitar. And I'm like, what is happening right now? And then I was so full of myself that I thought I was better than anybody in that area. Like, and I'm the new kid on the block. And this guy put me in my place so fast. And then he goes in the back and starts playing piano. Yeah. I'm like, oh, stop it already. For real.
He's one of those guys like Stuart Copeland said about Sting. He should have been drowned at birth.
Oh, my gosh. You have no idea how many times I wanted to break his hands. I mean, I couldn't. Oh.
So let's talk about the people instrumental in getting you guys this deal, because we're still talking about the first record. Now, you mentioned Doc McGee. Was he managing you before you had the record deal?
Yes. He was managing John at the time. And so we're over at John's house, and we're getting to the point where we think we're pretty close to, you know, having the whole record written. We wrote like, I don't know, 20 some odd songs, and we were continually writing. And so Rachel and I are at John's house and Doc is there. And then all of a sudden we're just chilling out and Doc comes over and starts going, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do this and we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And we're sitting there looking at him and we're like, okay, okay, okay. And then he goes, okay, cool. And walks away. And Rachel and I look at each other and go, is he managing us now?
It was never like a definite, yeah, okay, I'll manage you guys. It was just, all right. And we're driving home back to my parents' house. And we're like, is Doc McGee our manager? We was McGee Entertainment. What is going on here? There was never anything said. It was the weirdest situation ever.
And Doc, obviously huge at the time, managing Motley Crue and the Scorpions and Bon Jovi. And now he's got you guys as well. So that was a huge coup to be with him.
It was, oh my gosh. It was, we were awestruck by the whole thing. And it's so foreign, because as Rachel stated earlier, you know, we grew up in these working class communities, and you know, the furthest that you've ever traveled is, you know, to the bar down the street, you know, to hang out with your buds. And just this whole world was opening up in front of us. And it was so exhilarating, man. And we were taking it all in, and it did not get lost on us at any point. We were really, really like I said, awestruck by the moment. And there were a lot of moments. And so when finally we realized that we were being managed by Doc, I think it really, that the light bulb went on and we were like, this is for real. Like, this is really happening. And
I'll never forget what he said. He goes, so if you want out of this, draw a warm bath and get a nice shot with your blade.
That's and I was like, out.
Is this guy a manager?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk about the missing piece of the time. You know, whatever's gone on in the last few years or whatever. At the time, Sebastian, when you got him, great singer. And I used to say he was like genetically created in a lab to be a rock star, just the way he looked and all that sort of stuff. Because you, at this point in time, you had another singer, right?
Yeah. Guy by the name of Matt.
Also ex-singer of Anthrax.
Yeah.
He sang with them for a time. Yeah.
Poor Matt. It'd be like if Pete Best. it'd be like if Pete Best was the drummer of the Beatles and the Stones.
Oh my gosh, dude! I never thought about that. Oh,
poor guy. But how did Sebastian come on your radar? And how did you decide that you needed to get another singer? Because that's a big change to make for a young band.
There was a couple factors. I mean, once we knew we were getting rid of Matt, we just started auditioning people and getting tapes, and John helped us with that. He mentioned something in Metal Edge magazine and to send tapes, and boy, did we get a ton of them. And I don't think we ever really auditioned any of them from the tapes because it was some of the craziest shit that we ever heard. But there were some guys that were supposed to audition and, you know, didn't make it down. And we've been looking for about 9 months. We actually only auditioned, I think we auditioned less than 10 people, but it was just over a really long span. And then someone told us about Sebastian, and we were at the point where we're like, okay, he looked cool. Let's get him down here and check him out. And to be honest, the audition did not go well. We were like, whoa, this thing's way too high. Hmm. We like his attitude now. Yeah, but he sings way too high. We got to get him back into the stratosphere, you know what I mean? And then we went and we got up and jammed a couple songs just at the local club, this place called Mingles, and that went decent. So then we decided to keep him in the band. But you know, every time I see him, he's like, why did I not come to the audition? John Corabi.
Oh. Yep.
No keys.
To this day, he's like, yeah, that was a good idea. Me blowing off the audition with you guys.
Did he blow it off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I had known John from Philadelphia right before he moved to LA. And so when Rachel and I started putting this together, he was one of the guys that was still on the radar. And so, yeah, we reached out to him and he was like, blew it off.
Did you ever reach out to him over the past few years when you had different singers coming in?
You know what? No, we didn't.
No, he was always in doing something. Gotcha. You know?
So let's talk.
And you know what's interesting too? Wait, Chris, real quick.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting too about the thing with Matt, our original singer, was that we had gone out for three shows at the beginning of the Bon Jovi Slippery When Wet tour with Matt and the band.
Oh, really?
And we, mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a couple shows, or three shows in Pennsylvania right before Cinderella joined the tour. And so we played those three shows, and Doc McGee came into the dressing room after the first or second show and just went, band looks great, the band sounds great, the songs are great, singer's got to go.
Wow.
And that's what happened.
That was it. So
think about that though. So you're out there playing in front of, you know, 7,000 to 10,000 people sold out, and people are responding to you. So you think you're really on the verge of this really happening. And then all of a sudden, it's like the guy who's in the know and knows more than us comes back and says that. And it was tough, man. It was tough. And then to go 9 months in search of someone
wow.
to fit the bill. And I mean, there was a point, Rach, you remember this, we were going to just go out and start playing as a four piece of punk band and call it This Blows. because it did. It sucked.
It was so frustrating.
Rachel was going to sing. We were going to do like Ramones and Pistols and Dead Boys and stuff like that.
But people don't realize it's so hard to find the right singer. I mean, especially when you're told to find a new one. The guys that don't grow on trees because, once again, it's not just the vocal. It's the look. It's the attitude. It's the phrasing. It's the frontman skills, which are so hard as well. So it's not an easy task. Yeah.
No, it certainly is not. But you know what? At that particular time, we all figured it out. Thank God.
Let's talk a little bit about Jason Flom, because I think he falls through the cracks, especially this day and age when you know, Jason was an A&R guy, which basically means he finds and signs bands. And he had such a track record. I'm just Googled him here for Tori Amos, Twisted Sister, White Lions, Stone Temple Pilots, Jewel, Hootie and the Blowfish, Collective Soul. He kind of he's the one who signed you guys to Atlantic?
Yes.
Him and our good friend Dorothy Carvello, she was instrumental, as was Jason, to convince Amit and Tunj and Doug and all those guys that we were suited for that label. And thank God we went with Atlantic, because we were signed to Geffen.
Yep.
But the ink wasn't to paper yet. And then in the 11th hour, Jason came in with the offer from Atlantic. And it just, we were bummed, believe it or not, when they came in and when Doc told us, okay, we're signing with Geffen. We were like, we did a showcase for them, and the producer that they brought in and the A&R guy scrapped all of our songs except for two. And we played 30 songs for him.
Wow.
Dude. I should say all the songs that are on the first record.
Yeah. 18 Life, Youth Gone Wild, I Remember You, all the songs.
They wanted them scrapped?
Yep.
And then they wanted these really poppy metal songs that we had written that Snake and I didn't even want to play, but our day-to-day guy, our manager at the time, said, play everything. And we were like, we don't want to play these songs for the rest of our lives, you know?
Right. Yep.
And so they came in and... Yep, scrapped most of what's on the first record and then loved all the poppier ones that we didn't like. And so right then it dawned on us. It's like, okay, Geffen wants a poppier metal band, like in the vein of Bon Jovi. Atlantic wants a dirtier metal band in the vein of Guns N' Roses, each of which neither one. So when Atlantic came in, it was like, oh, thank God. You know what I mean?
Because
they had been courting us for a while. Jason put in a lot of time. Dorothy put in a ton of time and went to bat for us at the office. And it was the right place to be. Just all things considered, making the band happy and as hard as those two worked at getting us there. It was just the right place to be.
They were both labels were coming to our shows in New Jersey and New York. And we were rehearsing at Rachel's parents' house in the garage, and we get the phone call from Doc, and like Rachel said, he said Geffen, and we all looked at each other like, oh no, man, this is a bad move. And so he realized, like, we had so many reasons why, as Rachel stated, and plus they were an LA label, and they, you know, it's so funny because the A&R person said to us, well, where do you guys rehearse? And we were like, Tom's River, New Jersey. He's like, well, you'll never see me down there. And we're like, yeah, we did. Way to really be into what we're doing, man. And Dorothy and Jason were the polar opposites to that. And they were everywhere. Even when they found out that we were going to be signing with Geffen, they still showed up at the show. And that's when we were like, it happened like a week later or 2 weeks later after we were told about Geffen, that Doc called us back and said, okay, we're going to do it with Atlantic.
That was in Studio One, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was one of our worst shows ever. And here we have the two labels that are wanting to sign us, and we were horrible. And we got off stage, and everyone's in the dressing room just looking at the floor, not wanting to make eye contact with us. We're like, oh my God, we just blew everything. You know what I mean? But
a bad show for you was a good show for them because they'd never seen you before.
Possibly.
You know, because that's the thing, too. You're talking about, like, because when we go through the songs, you know, Can't Stand the Heartaches, a little bit of a poppier tune. But Skid Row was always, I remember how not shocked, but when Slave to the Grind came out, how heavy and fast it was. But you can see that those fingerprints all throughout Skid Row. You guys were always much more of a heavier Priest type vibe than a Bon Jovi Poison.
I agree. With Snake's musical background and my musical background, I think it all came into those songs, you know, because we both did grow up listening to British pop and stuff like that. But he was the metal guy. Snake was the British metal, and I was the punk guy. The punk, you know, guy, what I mean? I think the common thread was the 60s and 70s pop, but all that other stuff just kind of engulfed it, you know, the metal and the punk. And I think that was the formula to that first record. But yeah, I believe the fingerprint was there to set up Slave for sure. And at that point, we're like, well, we could take a couple liberties here, which we did, and decreased our album sales by at least half. But less chicks showed up for the show, that's for damn sure.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Wait, let's talk about when you guys recorded the record. When you're doing something like this, and people always ask me a question about some of the bigger songs that we've had. Did you know that the song was going to be a hit? Did you know that Youth Gone Wild was going to be a hit, or 18 in Life? Considering that the other label wanted to scrap them, when you're doing them, are they just another day at work, or do you realize there's something special about some of these tunes?
I don't think that we thought anything was going to be a quote-unquote hit. We just knew that there were certain things that were obviously standing out for us as musicians and songwriters and as a band. But, you know, it's funny because you have all these different opinions coming in. I mean, you know, originally it was supposed to be Big Guns was supposed to be the first single. Mm. And I remember we were like, felt weird about that. And I mean, Youth Gone Wild was an obvious statement. It was the first thing that you listen to and you go, okay, I know what this band is about. Mm-hmm. And so luckily, you know, better heads prevailed and we went with Youth Gone Wild, and that completely set the tone for the record. But then, you know, you got a song like I Remember You. And so the label goes, you know, after Youth Gone Wild started losing some legs and you need to come out with something next, the label's like, okay, I Remember You. It's the obvious choice. And we're like, no,
yeah,
no. And I'll never forget, we were in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and we were on the phone with our management and Jason Flom. And we were like, it's got to be 18 in Life next. It can't be I Remember You, because there's nowhere to go after I Remember You. And this might be the difference between an album lasting 9 months or an album lasting 2 years. And we need longevity here. We're going to, you know, we're on tour with Bon Jovi. We're in front of sold out audiences every night. We're going to get more tours coming our way because of the exposure we're getting and the amount of records that we're selling with Youth Gone Wild as a single. And luckily, they listened to us. And that was completely an idea that came from our side of the camp. That was not a record label idea. We had to sit there and fight for that. Go ahead, Rich.
The one that fought the hardest was Richie Sambora. He was like, this has to be it. And he said the same thing. And I'll never forget what our manager said. You know, remember, Snake?
I don't know. Refresh my memory.
You're at least a second. You could kiss your career goodbye.
Oh, like, my gosh.
And that's when Richie came up to bat. And he's like, nope, nope. He's like, you can't go with I Remember You, go with 18 in Life. And we were just like, oh, thank God. Somebody's on our side with this, you know?
No, why are you guys saying that I Remember You would have been the end of the record?
It was more like a final statement of what the album would be. It just, given the culture of that particular time, where music was, and especially for the area that we sat, it didn't, 18 in Life or anything coming after I Remember You seemed like it just wouldn't work. That seemed like what would be, at least to us, what would be the final statement of the record. And it just
that
made
was
sense.
Pretty much the formula that every other metal, pop metal band was doing at the time. And you'd never hear another song after it. They tried, but it wouldn't take hold. So we were really worried. We're like, okay, so the logical thought was they want something slow. Let's go with 18 in Life. It has a great story behind it. We can make a killer video and, you know,
because you're right. That was always the pattern. You'd have The Rocker would be the first single, and then The Ballad would be the second single. Yeah,
right.
It was hard to come back from that unless you had a huge record label push behind you as an established band, maybe.
Yeah, and it worked. It worked, and you know, made us think we were smart and knew what we were doing.
Hey, let me use a line from one of your videos. If you think, you stink.
Yeah.
But that's the 18 in Life is such a different song too, very interesting for that time frame, because it starts out ballady, but it gets really heavy, and it's like you said, it kind of falls somewhere in the middle between rocker and ballad,
right? And it has kind of a deep story to it, and it resonated with a lot of people, like maybe not literally, but I've had so many people tell me like, man, that song got me through some really bad shit, or, you know, I was contemplating doing really bad things to myself until I heard this song. And still to this day, I still hear,
you know,
that.
When it came out, a couple of things I was going to say. First of all, when Youth Gone Wild came out, I remember I used to go to this little local bar in Winnipeg called Georgie's for 35-cent draft night. Yeah, imagine how quality that draft was.
But oh, I love it.
I remember when Youth Gone Wild came out, because they would play, you know, they played at Georgie's, and everyone was just headbanging and just going crazy and throwing glasses against the wall. Like, it had such energy to it that a lot of bands didn't have. There was a real rebelliousness to it, and being a youth at that point, it really resonated with me and all my friends. Everyone in town was talking about Skid Row at that time.
Wow. That's really cool, man. That's really cool. Thank you.
And when the single came out, did you guys get the same vibe from everywhere? I mean, it was a pretty big hit right out of the gate.
It was so weird, man. When it really took hold and was on the radio a lot, you'd just walk down the street or be doing something and you'd hear people just singing the chorus to you. You know what I mean? It's like, wow, that's really cool, man.
Yeah.
But we, you know, man, when we wrote it, we were just kind of writing a story of ourselves, you know, and not thinking that it would be commercially successful or that it would touch a nerve with so many people, you know. But I guess everyone's kind of living the same life in different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were, that was, I mean, if you can't get more straight from the soul of who we are than that. And I remember we were playing Summers on the Beach in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was in February. And there was the first time, like, we were getting ready to do sound check, and we're standing around, and MTV was on, and the video came on, and it was like, holy crap, man. Like, we're on MTV now. This is amazing. Yeah. And then, you know what? MTV played a huge part, and because it gave us a platform to have visibility everywhere. And they were not shy in playing our that video, thank God. Because that, combined with radio, combined with a sold-out tour that lasted nearly 9 months or 8 months, we were just so fortunate. I mean, what you have all those three factors working in your favor, and we were fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time and you know, a good amount of luck.
Helped you get laid a lot, too.
What's that?
I said it helps you. It helped us get laid a lot.
Boy, you're not kidding me.
You know, when you have a chick in your room, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you come on MTV, things just change. All of a sudden, she picks up the phone and calls friends and all that stuff.
Yeah. That's you? Oh my God. What's the influence of Michael Wagner on the record? Because I just read an article, and you might have probably heard about this, where he said that the first Skid Row record is his all-time favorite album that he's ever worked on. And this is a guy who worked on Master of Puppets and No More Tears and, you know, Dokken Records and all these classic albums, Alice Cooper and except. What was his advice and kind of influence on the record?
Just a tremendous influence. He became the overlord, if you will, and I say that as a compliment. Mm-hmm. He was able to somehow corral these five over-exuberant children together to make a cohesive record. He has this ability with us, still to this day, because we're working on our new record with him, to bring the best out of us from a performance standpoint and to really grasp and pull our spirit out and get that documented. And his fingerprints are all over that first record. I mean, he was, without him, that first record would not be what it was. I can honestly say that. He just was the right guy for us.
We met with so many different producers, and we just did not, like, that produced a lot of albums that we really liked at the time, and we just did not click with them, and we didn't like their approach to what we wanted to do. And Jason flew Michael to Providence, Rhode Island, and we played this place. What was that place called?
The Living Room.
The Living Room. And so we sat at a little table in the bar, and I believe it was Scott, Snake, myself, Jason, and Michael. And Snake said, so what would your approach with this be? And he said, I want the band to be the band. And right then, Snake and I looked at each other and we're like, this is a dude. This is a guy.
Yeah. Hmm.
I mean, obviously his track record,
you know, but
it was stupid. And so we were like, oh, this is the guy. This is the guy. We told Scott that day, let's start. This is what we need. This is the only person that will understand what we're trying to accomplish. And we were right.
Was there any other producers of name that you talked to? So the famous story about Paul Stanley being the first guy up for the Appetite for Destruction gig. And then of course that didn't work out. Was there anybody like that came by?
John suggested Steven Van Zandt.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, he actually came to a few rehearsals, and he was just like, they're not ready. But, you know, we probably weren't at the time.
Right. But,
and a lot of guys like, listen, all these people are great. They're great at work.
Oh, Max Norman was one. And we
Max
were like
Norman, Rick Browdy. And there was so many. We met with quite a few. And we just didn't vibe. And it was for nothing less of we knew what we wanted, you know, and they all went on to make amazing records after, you know, Skid Row record. But Wagner just came in, and it's like we were so comfortable around him, and he just, he was just literally, not to sound cliche, he was the sixth member of the band. He just knew
for sure
what he wanted, and he knew how to get the right performances out of us.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Thinking about the cover of the album, it's really cool because, once again, and all jokes aside, you guys had a great look. Everybody had killer hair, and obviously you have Baz in the middle, and Rachel's got the nose ring, and there's some real attitude. But the cover of the record, it's got attitude, but you don't really see you guys. Was that a concept that you had, and how do you feel about the cover 30 years later?
Well, The Snake and I went into the art director because we had a whole bunch of photos. We had photos that Mark Weiss took, photos that I want to say David Kennedy. Is that correct, Snake?
Yep, that was his name. That's the one, that cover shot.
Yeah, because we really liked the Georgia Satellites cover of their record. And we're like, let's do something with this guy. We want to do it in an alley. So we did a bunch of stuff in the alley that Mark Weiss had, which was built. And then there was an alley that was in New York City, which is the front cover. And we went in, and it wasn't really an alley. It was just a parking lot entrance. And it was so new and so clean. I'm like, this isn't an alley. I go to the art director, I forget his name, but I go, I could find 10 alleys that are better than this in New Jersey. He goes, I'm not going to New Jersey. And it's like, wow. Okay. So Snake and I had all the photos, and we went, everyone approved. They looked like in the photos, and we had the pile of them, and we said, okay. And we had the back cover with Snake in the middle. And we're like, here's the cover we want. Here's the back cover, which is the front cover. And being new and not having any clout, art director said, nope. And we were sent to it was switched around completely.
That's always the way, right?
Yeah.
It fits, though. It fits, like you said, that it's got some great attitude there. And I also love how you mentioned Mark Weiss. I saw him at the Garden a couple months ago taking pictures for Kiss. I love the 80s when even the photographers were stars. Even fans knew the photographers were, right?
Oh, yeah. So many of them, man. And we had the pleasure of shooting with so many of them. I mean, Eddie Malouk and Mark Weiss and Ebet Roberts and William Hames and Ross Halfen and
Neil Slozauer,
Glenn LeFerman. I mean, you know, we just saw Neil on the Monsters of Rock cruise, and he's just the same guy. He's never changed, never wavered. No matter how successful or whatever he's been, he's still the same guy. I think the world of that dude. And mostly all of them are. Ross Halfen still calls me the second ugliest man in rock and roll. And so
who's the ugliest?
I forget who he said, but I was pissed. I was like, dude, I'm not second place, buddy. I want number one.
Rachel, I have Snake in my phone listed as ugly Michael Sweet. Let's talk about the track listing here. And if you have any fun stories or thoughts about each song, I always like to do this. I did it with Duff on the Appetite for Destruction. And like you mentioned, kicking off with Big Guns, still a great opening tune, for the set. Any memories of that song?
Yeah, we originally were going to have something going on. Like, do you remember that Cheech and Chong skit, Sister Mary Elephant?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, class, wake up.
Right.
Thank you. Well, we recorded this whole piece that was going to go before it that had the Looney Tunes thing playing in the background. You hear everyone just snoring and shit like that. And Wagner come in, come on, you got to get, it's time to record now, time to make a record, blah, 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 blah. And then he screams, wake up, and it goes, bam. So we did it. I'm glad it didn't make it because now, nowadays, it's really corny, but
right.
Here's at that point we're like, okay, Scott's like, okay, we got to get the licensing on the Looney Tunes theme, and he comes back and goes, yeah, it's going to cost you guys about $50,000 a year to have that on there. We're like, okay, go straight into the big G chord, that's fine.
Well, that was back then when everybody had some kind of an intro to your records, right?
Yep.
It's much better as is, for sure.
That would have been quite a bit different from like the intro to Number of the Beast. Probably like the exact opposite.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. The exact opposite of Battery.
Yeah, exactly.
Just looking at the songwriting here, it's the only song on the record that that all four of the musicians wrote, including Rob Afuso. What was his contribution to the song?
Good question. Good question. I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe his name should just be removed because we can't remember.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll be happy with that when the royalty checks start coming in.
Yeah,
another great tune, I love the lyrics that you guys always wrote together too. For Sweet Little Sister, she blew my mind behind the wrecking machine, a shit little trouble called the Subway Queen. Like, it's very dirty and definitely not your action satisfaction type of lyrics.
That's more Rachel than me, truth be told. And Rachel, throughout the history of this band, has always been the better lyricist than me. And he's great with metaphors. He's really good, like, believe it or not, and I don't mean to embarrass him, but he's very good with the English language, like, as far as how certain words go together. And it's really, it's wild. And so, you know, where I'll be, a lyric that I may come up with will be very black and white. His is always really colorful. There's great imagery and using a lot of metaphors and creating a picture that's very vivid. And so that those sort of lyrics right there are very indicative of what he does as a lyricist.
It's thank you, Snake. The song had a different title. Do you remember that, Snake?
I don't.
The chorus was rock, rock, rock. Rock, rock.
Dude, that's right. Oh, my God.
So we played it. And we went through it, and it had different lyrics and all this shit, and we played it. And I know Snake and I both walked away from rehearsal going, yeah, that one's going on the scrap heap. But we liked the music. And so I was driving up to Snake's mom's house. It was about a 45-minute drive, and I used to always carry a pad and pen with me, but I forgot it at home. And so I'm driving up there, and all of a sudden all the lyrics just kept coming into my head. So I got the first verse, and I'm like, okay, and I repeat the first verse, and the second verse came, and I repeated the first verse and the second verse, and then just kept going and going. And I ran into Snake's mom's house. Hey, Mom, Snake, do you have a pencil and a piece of paper? And I kissed her on the cheek, and she's like, I have a, she had, it was a pen that you do, like, tailoring with. What are they called? I forget.
Like a chalk pen, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you write like clothes with for the scenes. Yeah.
So she had that, and I ripped up, like, three paper towels off the kitchen roll, and I ran upstairs bedroom and closed the door and just started writing all this. And I go, Snake, I think I got the verses for this song.
That's great.
See, oh, I bet you haven't thought about that in 30 years.
Have not. I'll be honest with you. What a great memory, man. It's so
I haven't
crazy.
Used to brain that hard in 30 years. That's for damn sure.
How about the one song that I mentioned, which is, it kind of sticks out a little bit as more of the poppier type tune, Can't Stand the Heartache?
It was originally called So Bad the Heartache.
Yep.
John Bon Jovi suggested we change the title and just take a different approach to it. It was, it was just something simple and poppy. And then it was Michael's idea to put the a cappella thing on because it was just starting with the big chord. But it wasn't even starting with that. That was Michael's idea to just put us singing in three-part harmony and then boom into that. And yeah, it was super poppy. And it was funny. In some countries, people liked it a lot. And some countries, they did not.
It was one of those things where at the time, we're I don't want to say on the fence about it, but we were just questioning when we were putting the album together what fit best with everything else. And that's never an easy thing. Mm-hmm. To do when you're putting a record together and you've got, you know, 20, 30 songs, and then you whittle it down to, you know, 15 or 14, and then you end up putting 11 on the record. And, you know, there's always someone's going to be butthurt one way or another. And it was one of those things that it was a bit on a fence. And we said, you know what? This will work well within the context of the whole thing. So that's why we put it on.
Yeah. One thing, once you got Sebastian's voice wrangled down into the stratosphere, he's got some great just intonations, very ballsy at times. He can go super clean at times. So he actually sings the shit out of this song. I just listened to this record in its entirety for the first time in a long time, because nowadays everything's on shuffle. But that song actually, it came across much better than I remembered, because the vocal is very good and it is super catchy. So once again,
thanks.
Yeah, it's completely opposite of the next one though, which is much more of a almost a punky, dirty song, Piece of Me.
Great song, and Before Rachel, let me add real quick. Great song that I couldn't stand when Rachel first wrote it.
Really?
Yep, couldn't stand it, man. And I you know what? It's songwriting is a weird thing. We're very, very sensitive about it. You know, like when you create something, you're very, very sensitive, especially at that age,
mm-hmm.
and especially when you're doing something that's leading to something bigger, or you hope it leads to something bigger. So you're really, really critical. But the person who writes it, you know, this is their creation. They yeah. came up with this from nothing. You know what I mean? So it's really it's sacred, and you become attached to it, and you're very protective of it. So if someone is even a little bit critical, it's going to get blown up. At least with me, it gets blown up in your mind, like, oh my God, you're attacking my family. And so with that song, I guess I couldn't keep how I felt about it. Like I didn't like it. But Rachel, to his credit, took that and was like, I think that we should keep doing it, though. And he was persistent in a good way, because everybody else liked it. And so it was like, okay, if I'm the only guy. But I grew to absolutely love it. I love playing it in a set. I love, which is one of the songs that we've done, I guess, basically every show since the song was written.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show you that, you know what, you can be blatantly wrong about something. And I thought that it should, at first I was like, this isn't a Skid Row song, and there's no way. And then, you know, turns out to be that I love it, and I'm so happy that it was written, and I'm so happy that he was persistent about it.
We were writing Making a Mess up at Snake's house, at his mom's, in the room upstairs, and he had to take a piss. And I just started messing around, and I'm like, doo, 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 came up with that. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'm going to work with this when I get home. And then when I brought it, Snake goes, I'm not playing any song that sounds like the Munsters theme.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I can't believe that you – I was hoping you wouldn't remember that, because I wasn't going to bring it up. That's awesome.
Oh, man. And that's the thing, too. I mean, it's my second Police analogy of the show, but something that they said when they started playing the reunion in 2007, they were talking about how the songs don't belong to the band anymore. They belong to the people. And once that song gets out there, it doesn't matter if you like it or not. The fans like it. It's a Skid Row classic. So it's cool that you like it, but even if you didn't, it's not up to you anymore. It's up to playing what the fans enjoy and want to hear in a lot of ways.
Without a doubt. You yeah. have to always respect that, for sure. That's something that's always been prominent in our mindset when we're putting together a set list, for sure.
Next up is 18 in Life. Is this the biggest Skid Row song? Is it your biggest hit?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about how you wrote that one, because that's the one that you guys wrote together.
Well, that's your baby.
Well, it started out, one of my brothers, I have four older brothers, and the second oldest one, his name is Rick. And when I was a kid, Rick went to Vietnam, and he was my hero, man. He was raising me. My dad had left earlier on when I was like two, so he was raising me. He was like the father figure, and so when I was seven, he went off to Vietnam, came back a couple years later, and he wasn't, you know, physically injured, but he was just different, as anyone who experiences that is going to be. Didn't have the same sort of life force that he had before he left. So that stayed with me and still stays with me to this day. So I had, you know, Ricky was a young boy, and it was originally he had a heart of gold.
Oh.
And the idea was I brought this to Rachel, and I was like, okay, I got this idea, and all I have is these two lines. And I said, but this is what I'm thinking, and that is, let's tell the story of him going to Vietnam, coming home, and just this whole story. Well, we were working on it, and nothing was working. It just wasn't clicking. We couldn't do the actual story justice through the song. So we decided to take another turn and say, let's just create a story, like using that as an influence, but let's create a story. Let's create this Ricky character. Who is this Ricky character? So Ricky went from was a young boy to having a heart of gold, went to had a heart of stone.
Hmm.
And they're like, okay,
And right, if I could interject, right then we knew the direction, which direction we were like, okay, we all know a kid like this.
Yep.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
No, no, you're absolutely right. And that's important because it changed the whole complexion of the song. It changed, the path that we were taking with it. And from there, it kind of just snowballed, to be honest. Rachel was coming up with a lot of these very, vivid and colorful, imaginative lyrics. And when we got to the chorus, it was, we got a bunch of direction. I should say a bunch of direction. Well, we got direction of what we were doing from John and Richie. Like, this is a great story. Now you need that thing that sums up the song, sums up this person, sums up the what this whole thing is about. And it's just, again, a lot of times you just open the window and things come in. It's really not your fault. It just comes from somewhere else. And you're just the vessel, And right. And that's what happened with that particular song. I think that when you have those moments, they're indescribable, where you kind of like those double take moments where you look at each other like as if you're in the Little Rascals, like what?
Right.
Like it's just an incredible feeling. Like you just, I don't know where that came from, but thank God it did. And
it was the first time we really started working with metaphors writing wise, like, because the whole thing, it's not like 18 in life. A lot of people call it 18 to life. It's like, no, it's 18 and life. And they're like, what's the and? I was like, he's trapped inside himself, man. He can't get away from the person that he is. That's the whole sentence that he's doing, But hey, we just provide the canvas and the paint, what I mean? And everyone else does what they do.
Yeah. And once again, that's the beauty of a great song is that, what does it mean? Well, it means, what does it mean to you? What does it mean to the individual listener? Because I was 18 when this song was released. And to me, it was almost like 18 in life. It's like you're 18. You got your whole life ahead of you. You could either fuck it up or you can do anything you want. Like I didn't, that's kind of, it's a life sentence that you're 18 and now you got your life sentence in front of you, which you can do it.
Right.
Make it whatever you want to make it into, kind of a thing,
And that's where we were too. I mean, when the song was written, we didn't have a record deal. We didn't even have the whole band together yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that song was written with Matt in the band and demoed with him. And so it was, we were working again, we were working our asses off and that's where we were at. It made so much more sense because we're at such a young age that those lyrics were befitting of what we were going through in a way.
And what your fan base is going through too.
Yeah, I guess, and that's the thing. Again, you can't predict what's going to connect with people. You can only just hope, do your best. And that connected with a lot of people, thankfully.
Was there any issue with Rattlesnake Shake? Not issue, but it's very funny because Motley Crue, who put out Dr. Feelgood about 6 months after this record, also had a song called Rattlesnake Shake. Did they rip you off? Did you rip them off? Did you ever ask them?
Well, Aerosmith had a song as well.
Oh, well, there you go. You guys both ripped off Aerosmith then.
Everyone ripped off the blues song. I forget who did it, but it's old blues title.
Gotcha.
We have 4 hours.
Another great a bunch of lyrics from that. And yours is much heavier than Motley Crue's too. So,
it's funny. You can't copyright a song title, which is, I guess, a good thing. But that song, we were spending a lot of time going back and forth to Philadelphia, working in a studio down there a little bit, and just going and partying down on South Street and stuff like that. And so, when we started working on this song. Tricky Little Vicky walks along South Street. It was like, okay, let's encapsulate like what we encounter when we're down there and make a colorful story out of it.
And the original Rattlesnake Shake by Fleetwood Mac in 1969.
Wow, you're a Googler.
Yeah, I am a Googler. I'm a host. I got to be, like I said, I'm a technological whiz now after doing this show for so long.
Wasn't there another one before that though? Or was that the first one?
That's the one I can find right now. They probably did it from somebody else too, right? So we already mentioned, let's see who wrote it. No, Peter Green wrote Rattlesnake Shake. So there might have been one earlier than that. But okay. That's a Fleetwood Mac one. So we've talked a lot about Youth Gone Wild. Anything else that you remember about the writing of the song?
Had different lyrics.
Yep, had completely different set of lyrics.
Really?
Yep.
Let me see if I could think of it. Oh, man. Yeah, it was more as if we were rock stars, you know, about growing up and still being young and still having too much, getting too much too soon type of thing. And it was Jon Bon Jovi said, you know what? I love these lyrics, but it's not going to resonate with anyone that lives in Des Moines. And we're like, all right, he goes, start from scratch. Think of it as not as yourself as much as you guys and a bunch of other guys your age.
What great advice, though, man. Like, that's so cool that he gave you so much insight as to how to connect with the people. Because Bon Jovi, much like his hero, I'm assuming Bruce Springsteen, they come across so everyman. And like, you know, we believe in you, Bruce. We believe in you, John. And this is a perfect example of the same thing.
Without a doubt. And again, like, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like just the great coaching, you know, like we'll talk about having an invaluable asset by someone who's just going to sit there and tell you the honest truth based on their experience and whatever wisdom they may have at that particular point of their career. And he was obviously, him and Richie and the band were obviously hugely successful, still are. And for him to, you know, be able to sit there and give us that advice and of which we could utilize, it was, you can't put a price on that, man. I mean, it's
a
helped
mentor. Yeah.
And it helps. It obviously helped shape what the band became and sure. What we are today.
I don't think I've ever gotten them in correct order, but I just remember screaming, we live our lives on trial. We walk the endless mile. We call us problem child. I know the words, but no one ever got them right. Like, they're always out of order or whatever it was, but everyone's screaming it, you know, at Georgie's, for example. So I'm still not sure if I ever got it right, but it sure was fun screaming out those that chorus.
Why don't you say it correctly next time?
You're booky Canadian.
I could have Googled it, I guess, right? Jeez, the amount of disrespect I just showed to my guests here.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
You're out for a rip, bud.
Going out for a rip, eh? Hey, I heard that Skid Row, man. Youth Gone Crazy. It's fucking great, man.
Hey, man, let's go get dickered.
As we get towards the end here, you got Here I Am, another super heavy song with some great lyrics. She broke a million hearts in Second Avenue with German cigarettes and designer attitude. What the hell did you know about German cigarettes in 1988, Rachel Bolan?
I knew they had them in Germany. I guess it's just watching foreign films. I don't know. I'm trying to think of the lyrics to that song. We haven't done it in so long.
Did you ever think about, I know that that Baz is doing the album in its entirety. Did you ever think of doing anything like that or just leave it up to him to do
it? Yeah, we did. We did. It's just, and we still may, but it's just one of those things where we have momentum with new stuff and Z's only in the band for 3 years. And we don't want to isolate it to such a small thing, you know.
Gotcha.
Not small, I mean, don't want to just do the first album. We want to do other songs that people want to hear, you know, so that's kind of where we're at right now. But there's always time to do something
you
like that.
You should put a Here I Am in there or Making a Mess if you haven't played it in a while. I bet you people would dig that.
Oh, we play Making a Mess like basically every show.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, well, but Here I Am, you know, when we were writing this first record, there's so many different places where Rachel lived and where I lived. So that particular one, he was like on his third floor walk-up apartment, right? Was that the one in Long Branch, maybe?
Or yeah, right floor? From the train station.
Right. And so, like, we would live in different places, and that particular song was written in that particular place. And I remember we were just sitting in your living room, and it was not that it was sparse, but we didn't have a lot of money. But I remember it was such a great feeling because I was like, Rachel wrote that riff. I was like, dude, like, that's a really cool riff. Like, me, I would have added about 75 more notes in that riff because that's what I do as an idiot guitar player. Rachel being a bass player doesn't look at the guitar like I look at it. He looks at it just, it's a vehicle. And me, I it's a vehicle, but I get to be very mathematical sometimes about it, which is not a good thing. And he just goes straight from a feel standpoint. So he's like, check out this riff. And I was like, dude, this is like a great riff. Like, I'm proud to play this. And then, again, we're
well,
in
like that piece of me riff. No, just kidding.
Right. But we were in that mode. We were in that mode of like this, just this colorful, very streetwise lyrical storytelling. And that goes right along like with the lyrics with Rattlesnake or with Sweet Little Sister.
And once again, that's another song that I think gets tied together so well with the vocals, and it's just a great tune. And then Making a Mess comes up, a little bit of a heavier tune. You talked about writing that. Now, this one also has a credit from Sebastian Bach, the only one on the record. Do you remember what Baz contributed to this?
I don't.
He was in the room.
He what?
He was in the room.
It's funny how one of our songs has a writing credit to the drummer, Frank. I'm like, what did Frank do on this? None of us, including Frank, can remember why he's on it. So maybe. But making a mess.
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. It was tough to. There's certain things that stand out, you know, 30 some odd years ago. And I can't recall that, though, to be honest.
How about another huge hit for you guys, I Remember You, which on every, you know, quote unquote 80s heavy rock, hard rock ballad compilations to the end of time, that's going to be on there. Anything behind that one, Snake?
There's a couple different things, interestingly enough. So I started with the strumming thing. It's just a G and a C chord. And at the time, Scotty, Robin Fuso, and I were living at my mom's house, and Scotty slept in an upstairs bedroom. And so I had this thing, and I go up to the bedroom. I start playing it for him. I'm like, yeah, check out this thing. And oddly enough, I go, it's kind of like a Springsteen thing or a John Cougar thing. And wasn't thinking about just, it was just writing. It wasn't specifically for anything. So Rachel and I, as we often did, if there was an idea, whether it was for Skid Row or not, we'd pursue it because it's, you're exercising that muscle. And so we started writing it, and we're writing these lyrics, and we were in a room, and it was raining outside. And we're like, okay, we need a first line for the song. We're like, how do we set the stage? And all of a sudden we go, well, it's raining. You know, somehow we came up, woke up to the sound of pouring rain. So, okay, now we've got a great first line. What happens next? And this is what Rachel and I always go through. Okay, what's the song about? What's the starting point? And then that sort of dictates where we're going, much as it did with 18 in Life. So we get to the chorus, and now this is maybe a week or two later, whatever it might have been. Now we're not in the green room anymore. We're out on the back porch of his mom's house with a couple acoustic guitars. So I wrote one set of lyrics for the chorus. He wrote another set of lyrics for the chorus. We're going back and forth about what lyrics we should use. And of course, I'm defending mine and he's defending his. So we sit there and go, well, let's try to put them together as one thing. That doesn't work. So then we found something that was right in front of us the whole time. Well, why don't we use both of them side by side? Mm-hmm. And it was like light bulb, bam, boom. So then we finished the song. And to be quite honest, we don't think much of it. We don't think it's a Skid Row song. So we bring it into rehearsal just to jam it. And we still don't think it's a Skid Row song. But the rest of the band is like, this is a great song. And Rachel and I are like, man, we don't see it. And Scott and Doc were there at one point. And they both said, if this song isn't on the first record, then we don't manage you anymore. And we were like, Rachel and I looked at each other like, well, okay, still, it didn't register with us yet. And I'll tell you, when the more we played it, the more, me personally, I liked it, but it still wasn't knocking my socks off. It was when we went in the studio and did it, and what Michael Wagner was able to pull out of Sebastian, and the way Michael produced that record, or that particular song, from all of our standpoints, what he was able to pull out of Scotty's solo, Sebastian's vocals, and the sound of the song captured what the essence was. And so, so accurately that it was, then it became undeniably a Skid Row song. But at first it was, you know, if it was, if it had been solely up to Rachel and I, that wouldn't have made it.
Unbelievable. And ends up being,
I know, right?
Ends up being, I said, an all-time classic.
Go to show you. I'm Polish. That should say it all.
Last song on the record, Midnight, of course, with the little denouement of Tornado. It's it's funny.
The what?
A denouement. That's a French word. Canadian.
Yeah, what is that?
That's
what
does a big word for a pro wrestler. What?
Even worse, a pro wrestler and a musician. I'm extra dumb.
Yeah, what's going on here?
I don't think anyone ever accused you of being a musician, but go ahead.
The denouement is the final part of a play, movie, or narrative in which the strands of the plot are drawn together and matters are explained or resolved, or the climax of a chain of events.
Do you have dictionary toilet paper or something?
I have that tattooed on my ball bag, actually. You want to come see it?
Snake wow. drops serendipitous. You drop that. I'm like, I feel really dumb over here. Cat.
A really small tattoo on that sack of yours.
Midnight, much more of a kind of a classic 80s sound. It actually reminds me a lot of Danger from Shout of the Devil, where you forget the song because no one really talks about it much, and then when you hear it, it's like, it's a pretty killer way to end off a record. And then I love kind of the little ending instrumental thing there. What was the story behind that?
Well, we used to open up with that song, and it was written with Matt, our first singer.
This is before I even knew Snake.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it had, if it feels a little bit different than some of the other stuff on the record, that's probably the reason why, because it's the oldest song that's on that record. And it was, again, I think that was also one of those songs we were iffy about, not iffy, but we were questioning whether it should be on the record or not, but it seemed to bookend pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
With everything kind of in between it. And, but we opened up with that for so long. It just, when I wrote the riff, I heard it as an opening song.
Opening tune, yeah.
But Rach, you tell the story about Tornado.
I just had a riff that I threw at the guys in the garage and we were messing with it. And Snake and I planned to write a song around it, but we just couldn't find where the song was. So we're like, we'll leave it and then maybe stick it. You know, just what it does as a fade out on the record. Well, it didn't have a title and it wasn't going to until while we were recording it, all the power went out in the studio because of tornadoes in the area. And we went back to our rooms because it was connected. The hotel was connected to the studio and I'm looking out, you know, I'm a kid from Jersey. I'm used to just dead bodies washing up on shore. I'm not used to seeing tornadoes come out of the sky. And you could see for miles, like, because there was nothing but cornfield like, for miles and miles and miles. And way in the distance, the sky turned like a purplish black color and this funnel came down. And I was like, what am I supposed to do? How am I going to get here? And what the hell am I supposed to do if it does? So, but then it got stuck back up into the sky and all the power came back on. And I went downstairs. I go, we should call that Tornado. And it stuck.
So. The idea of that, too, was we put it there. And then we had the idea to open up the next record with that riff as a song.
That's right.
And yet we still, when it came time to do it, it just wasn't where we were at. And we couldn't make that come to fruition. But that was the idea when we were done doing the record. But we were in a different headspace when we started making Slave. So
I always love that little bit because when you used to make mixtapes on cassettes, and if a song ended with only like a minute left and you wanted to fill up the tape, because I hated having like a minute or 2 minutes of empty tape, I would always stick Tornado at the end of it because it always is a great way to fade out of the cassette.
Nice. Oh, that's funny.
I love that. That's great.
Stuff that kids these days will never know. As we wind down here, I mean, you know, once again, this amazing record, 5 million albums sold in the States alone, which is a feat that you'll probably never see again from any band, just the way that things are. When you look back on it, what are your overall impressions about the record and playing these songs in this day and age?
I think that I'm so proud of what we did, all of us, everybody in the band at that particular time. I'm so proud of what we were able to accomplish. It's far above and beyond even what we hoped for. And the fact that people still, like yourself, like the fact that we're talking about it right now, some 30 years later, nothing but humility and gratitude and pride. And as much as I could sit here and say, I wish I played that guitar differently, or I wish this was different, the truth is that I'm glad that we didn't change anything. And I'm glad that it exists as it does, because you can't mess with what happened and what that record became and what it means to people. And had anything been different, those emotions may have been different too. So it's one of those things that, you know, from my standpoint, I look back and I smile, and I'm so thankful to have been a part of it. And something that we created could stand the test of time the way it does is very humbling. And, you know, I've always said this, the fact that when we go out and we play these songs, when you see an audience reciting those lyrics back to you, and you see in the passion that they're putting into it when they're singing those lyrics and when their hands are in the air, there's nothing that comes close to that, man. Nothing. And so I'm honored to have been, you know, a part of creating that.
We're talking three decades ago, and that seem, when you're on this side of it, it seems like, you know, just a flash went by.
Mm. Right.
Because, I mean, like, talking about it, is we're remembering just about every single moment of making the record before there was even a record to make, you know, just meeting Snake and getting together and writing songs and auditioning band members and whatnot and changing band members. And it to come out with something that was as special to millions of people as it was to us is just the most incredible feeling that you could ever feel in the world. It's like, I guess it's like, you know, I don't have any kids, but if I had a kid and say he went and became president or something like that, she's like, man, I did something really good for this to happen, and I'm really proud of him. So that's kind of what my take on the whole thing is. And just to, like Snake said, to even talk about this and talk about it with you you know, people celebrating it, and a special, you know, digital, you know, remaster of it came out and whatnot. It's like, wow, this is stuff you only heard about happening to other bands. Mm. You know, it's a pretty cool thing, man. I wouldn't change anything on that record.
What's your favorite song on the album?
Man, probably 18. Mm. I mean, and Youth would probably be my two favorites.
Snake?
I think it's Youth, and only because it was our introduction to this world. It was the first thing that we ever released, and that set the stage for literally our whole career. So I would think that.
Got it. And just for you guys, they call us Problem Child. We spend our lives on trial. We walk an endless mile. We are the youth gone wild. I got it. I nailed it.
Hey, look at you.
Wow. That's what you get. You, again, the Googler.
The Googler. And last question for you. You guys hate the reunion question, but when are you reuniting with Elwood Francis?
Oh. It's very soon.
Here.
You guys are thinking, oh, come on. You're going to ask that question? Elwood.
Great.
Prunella Scales, baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. It's so funny. I go back and forth with Elwood all the time on Instagram. He's hilarious.
The first time I ever met Snake at a little high school gym in Japan, you were with Elwood.
Yes, we were, man. We took two different trains in 2 hours to get there. It was worth every minute of it until you got in the ring.
It's like you thought you were going back to work at the guitar store.
I really did. As a matter of fact, I would have preferred that.
Oh, man. Well, guys, thank you very much. And like I said, it's a great moment in time in rock and roll. You guys are a great rock and roll band. And anybody who remembers this record, go back and listen to it. If you haven't heard it for a while, go back and listen to it. Just don't look at the back cover at any pictures of Snake Sabo because you might puke.
I'm actually going to be really nice to you, and thank you so much. In all honesty, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. It was very, very cool to relive a bunch of this stuff because there were things that I had forgotten about, and it was really cool to relive those moments. So thanks for doing this for us.
Yeah, in all, like I said, all seriousness, it was awesome to hear these songs, and great talking to you guys, and hopefully we'll get a chance to rock together again soon.
Thanks, hell buddy. Yeah.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, dude.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to Rachel and Snake from Skid Row. They're hitting the road September 25th. They're doing a handful of dates in the States before heading to Europe in November. All the dates and details at skidrow.com. And ChrisJerichoCruise.com has all the details on the upcoming Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea Part 2. We set sail January 20th, and we want you to be there too, along with this killer lineup of talent featuring the AEW top guys, Fozzy, Ric Flair, NWO, Jake the Snake Roberts, Light the Torch, Kick-Ass, the Guerrero Family, Vicky, Eddie, Shawl, Fozzy, like I said, Killer Queens, Dave Spivak Project, Jared James Nichols, DDP is going to be there, the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Cody, Brandi Rose, Adam Page, the Hangman, SCU, MJF, Paranormal Stories from Beyond the Darkness. So much going on at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. And as we stand right now, we literally have 19 cabins left. You don't want to be left out on this, man. It's going to be the vacation of a lifetime. And we still have more to announce. So go get one of those final 19 cabins now. And go to FozzyRock.com and come see us. The Unleashed in the West tour is off and running. We had a sold out show last night in Denver. Great time. Great to be back on stage. We're hitting Colorado Springs tonight at the Sunshine Theater. September 7th, Grand Junction, Colorado at the Mesa Theater. September 8th, Salt Lake City at the Royal. We're going all throughout Nevada, California, Arizona, Texas, Mississippi, Georgia. Don't forget, September 14th, Iron Maiden at the Bank of California Stadium. That one's sold out. Sacramento on the 13th at the Ace of Spades. So many gigs that we want to play for you. September 19th, Tempe, Arizona. September 20th, Tucson. Come see us, FozzyRock.com. And don't forget to pick up a VIP package, meet and greet VIP package. We play a little mini concert just for you guys. Rich and I were working out the set list today. FozzyRock.com. Hang with Fozzy before the show and come have a great time. Speaking of great times, we have a great weekend. And coming up Wednesday, he's the hottest act in AEW. I'm talking about the Luchasaurus. He and Jungle Boy and Marco Stunt, the Jurassic Express, tore down the house against SCU at All Out Chicago Saturday night. I talked about that earlier this week in my All Out review. And if you didn't know his name, you should and will now. You'll discover what the great Dusty Rhodes had to do with his gimmick. He's also basically like a Rhodes Scholar. No kidding. Luchasaurus is here on Wednesday. Until then, have a great weekend. Come see Fozzy if you're in Colorado. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy! They call us problem child. We live on life's on trial. We walk the endless mile. We are the youth gone wild.